Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
From the Webby Awards, I'm David Michelle Davies. This is the Webby Podcast.
Reflect, respect, and raise up.
Take the bands off our bodies. Ah.
Women, look what we did.
Take equality seriously. For real.
Hey there, and welcome back. My next guest has devoted her life to combating gender-based violence. Professor Anita Hill is a lawyer, an educator, and author, and we had the honor of welcoming her to this year's Webby Awards, where she was on hand to accept the Best Public Service and Activism Webby on behalf of Pineapple Street Media and The Meteor for the podcast Because of Anita. In 1991, she bravely traveled to Washington and testified to the U.S. Senate that then-Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas sexually harassed her. 30 years later, that pivotal moment continues to shape our country and how we deal with gender-based violence on social, political, and cultural levels. I can't say enough about Professor Hill's contributions to history, bravery, and willingness to continue doing the hard work. In addition to teaching at Brandeis, she's the author of a book called Believing, Our 30-Year Journey to End Gender Violence, which has been described as a book only Professor Hill could have written. She also hosts her own podcast, Getting Even with Anita Hill. We start off talking about the career she began to forge after those 1991 hearings.
Well, let me just start by saying people may not recall that in 1991, I was teaching at the University of Oklahoma College of Law. I'd just gotten tenure there a few years earlier, and I thought that I was going to remain there for the rest of my career. I hadn't any plans to change. I thought I'd do law teaching forever. Turns out, you know, by the mid-90s, I was questioning whether or not that was going to be the rest of my life. And so I made a decision to leave not only Oklahoma, which was where I was born, but I also left teaching law. I left teaching in a law school, and the teaching law in a law school is a very different experience from what I'm having today, which is to teach law in a policy school. But I've moved from Oklahoma to Massachusetts, teaching at Brandeis University in a graduate program, which is a PhD offering program, as well as many other degrees. And so I get to teach a variety of students, some of whom will become lawyers, but that's not their goal. Their goal is to be able to analyze policy, to be able to direct policy, to write policy that will be affecting all of us. And so I teach a combination of law and policy, and that's very different. I'm in a very different place geographically as well as professionally than I ever expected to be.
Some of that change reflects your interest in not just the law around gender violence, right? But the economic impact of gender violence, the social impact of it. That's a shift you made in your career, something you were interested in pursuing. Am I right there?
You're absolutely right. I made the shift because after trying to address the problems just strictly through the legal system, I realized that gender-based violence really happened and could only be corrected if we looked at it more broadly and looked at the problem holistically. So what I had learned over the years was that gender-based violence, let's say in the form of intimate partner violence, leaves people homeless. In some instances, people lose their families, they lose their children because of gender-based violence. And so the court system doesn't necessarily address that, especially when it comes to the homelessness problem. So I realized that I was being very limited in terms of what I could do by just looking at the problem from a legal sense. So I wanted to study with people and to work with people to see not only how gender-based violence was impacting people's lives in terms of their economic well-being, in terms of their jobs, in terms of their housing situations, but also in terms of how the culture and our culture was either helping to alleviate the problem or contributing to the problem. And what I found is that culturally, there are a number of contributions that people continue to make today when it comes to the topic of gender violence. We pull out still myths and tropes that have proven to be not factual, but we tell victims that the problem of their experience isn't so bad, so we minimize the problem. We in many cases blame victims of violence, or for especially sexual assault and rape, for being in the wrong place or for wearing the wrong clothing, and I put wrong in quotes. Sure. And so we still as a culture haven't turned the corner in terms of what our response is or should be to the problem. We have learned, I will say, over the last 30 years or so, we have learned to identify the problem, to identify the behavior more readily, and to acknowledge that it exists, but we have not come to terms with how we can resolve the behavior. How can we respond to it, either in terms of our response to victims or in terms of our response to the people who perpetuate it?
So what you're identifying there, just to sort of focus on one specific thing, which is the victim blaming. Have you gotten some further insight in these years as to why we're still stuck on that as an idea? Is it because we're uncomfortable with what the results would be if we didn't do that? The potential prosecution of the person who did it, or having to go through that, the discomfort, is that what it is? Or share a little bit with me about sort of your sense of why culturally we still do that.
Well, I think it's a combination of factors. I don't think there's any one factor. And I do think we have a hard time taking away power from powerful people. And usually what happens in a situation, whether it's harassment or assault, intimate partner violence or any of the other types of violence that I talk about in my book, what happens is that at the core of it is a power imbalance of some type. And so when you're talking about harassment in the workplace, for example, there is very often peer harassment, but also more often when you talk about quid pro quo sexual harassment in the workplace, there's a power imbalance. A manager or someone who has a higher position in a workplace is harassing someone else. And we tend as a society to take the word of the male who is more powerful. We tend to value that individual more than we value the, let's call it, say at the lower level employee. And so we're much more likely to simply say, well, let's don't make a big deal out of it. Or, in other words, she's not worth protecting. We value men's status and we disvalue or devalue women's status, participation, or even their right to bodily integrity and security. I think there are economic reasons for that. I think there are cultural reasons for it. I think there are all kinds of ways that we need to be looking at the problem. But the first thing that we need to do is to acknowledge that that is what's going on.
And you've called this a crisis, right? Yeah, you know, like it's an epidemic in society, and it has real economic consequences, not just for the people involved, but for like our country and for the world as a whole.
We are losing. We're losing in terms of productivity, effectiveness of people in the workplace to start. We're losing because of healthcare costs that go along with much of the violence that is experienced. We're losing just in terms of our overall productivity, but unfortunately, we don't keep track of that. So we can't say exactly how much in total the loss is. We know that there are individual losses, but no one really is keeping track of how much we are losing as a country. And I think we're also losing in terms of our ability to participate in our democracy. So I think the democracy suffers when people are pushed out of positions or pushed out of homes or pushed out of communities because of a threat to them, to their safety and well-being. And, we haven't even begun to quantify what that is and exactly what that means. When we talk about it as a crisis, one of the things that I contend is that our government has to respond to it as a crisis, and the government should be leading us in terms of measuring the real harm and understanding why that we need a response at the highest level.
In your conversation with Dr. Ford, in the, I think it was the penultimate episode of the podcast, you both talk about this concept of expectations, how you're supposed to act. Dr. Ford in the story focuses on how she thought she was supposed to act in the Senate, like literally how to behave, how to walk, and some of the things she had learned as a child, learning about the Senate and the chamber and sort of revering it. And you talked about how in your life, you've developed a sense of how you had to act in order to be believed. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think that culturally, we look for, first of all, the perfect victim. We look for that perfect individual who's going to come forward. And so all of our lives, we have been taught that our credibility, whether it's about sexual violence or gender violence, our credibility depends on how we present to the world. But it's not just, you know, limited to that setting when we're called upon or when we try to step forward to get someone to respond to violence. I mean, this is something that we live with every day. So as a young professor, we had one when I was first started teaching law school at the University of Oklahoma. I remember showing up for work one day in what I thought was a perfectly respectable pantsuit, and a female colleague said to me, "You know, well, you're not going to teach in that, are you?" Because we were expected to wear skirts. I mean, and this was, you know, this was not the 1920s or the 30s or 40s. Right. This was in the 1980s. And so you have to present in a certain way to be credible, to be a credible law professor. And so one of the things that I thought that my experience with Christine Blasey Ford that was different was that the kind of respectability that she could attain was very different from my own because she knew that she would be accepted in certain places. She knew that she would be accepted or how she could present herself in a way that people would acknowledge that she belonged in a space. And I knew from very early on in my life that there were places like the halls of the Senate that I would never be seen as belonging because of my race and gender combined. In 1991, for example, when I testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee, there were two women senators of the entire 100 group of senators. The women didn't even have a bathroom dedicated to them on the floor where their offices were. They had to go down to the floor where that was part of the public experience for people who were visiting the Senate to use the bathroom. Therefore, they had, you know, very little privacy, very little, you know, real attention to the dignity of their office because of their gender. So, you know, when I testified, of course, these two women, senators, were white women. They had never seen a Black woman senator. And so it was, I was not something that they had ever seen before. And I think just that alone triggered something in them to suggest not only that I didn't belong there, but what I had to say didn't need to be heard in the Senate chambers.
I mean, I think you made them very uncomfortable, right? Back to sort of what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, just like they were uncomfortable giving women senators bathrooms on the same floor. I mean, there are the things that we have to connect, I think, in terms of people's experiences that we sort of take for granted that we all, once you get to a certain point, then we can all enter a space and be received in the same way. But that still is not true. And it certainly wasn't true in 91.
As I was listening to you talk about that and just the overall, that idea around expectations, the thing that I was thinking as you were both discussing it was how low our expectations are for men in power and their behavior, which is not to say that people don't have individual responsibility for their actions that have done this. They 100% do. But to some extent, the country's reaction to your hearings at that time and all the actions between that and, you know, today do not necessarily raise the expectations or require or ask that men in power behave in a different way than they did before.
Oh, you're absolutely right about that. I mean, in fact, we have, you know, language that tells us that. I mean, we have grow up with language like boys will be boys. And, you know, of course, that's just what men do. And from my point of view as a law professor, I've seen that kind of language show up in court decisions, even Supreme Court decisions from Justice Anthony Kennedy sort of gave the impression that in one case that involved a fifth grader and another fifth grader who was abusing her was that, you know, that the really egregious sexual behavior that she was enduring was just normal childhood behavior and activity. And so that what we're told really is, you know, even by the highest court in the country, we're told that that's just something we have to put up with. So our expectations are very limited and our expectations of male behavior. But then you have to ask yourself, if that's the case, then why aren't all men harassers and abusers? And we know that's not the case. So we need to figure out, you know, why we are catering to those who are.
Really interesting. I want to shift here a little bit and talk a little bit about internet media and the role it's played in this sort of changing landscape and journey over, you know, over the past, you know, 20, 30 years, whether it be Twitter, social platforms or podcasts like yours. You know, I think these spaces act as a form of documentation and can be great ways to reach larger audiences. Do you think they've created more space for feminism and particularly Black feminism to thrive?
I think they have created space for a number of things. I think they've created space for affinity groups of people so that they can go to social media and be in conversation with and engagement with people who are like them or who have the same interest. And so I think that's just, that has been a plus in and of itself. But that also leads to people being able to get messages out. And I think Black feminism has really benefited from it. You know, I come at this from a position as a professor. And I, of course, you know, have seen the growth of a number of the young Black feminists who are online and using tech platforms and the internet to express themselves and to share their messages, even beyond the affinity group that they're in. The conversation that we're having right now about critical race theory, in many ways, is being led by Kimberly Crenshaw, and she's used the internet as a powerful media to get the word out about what critical race theory is and isn't. And it's having not only educational impact, but it's also having political impact, the work that she's doing. So I absolutely think that there is a huge benefit for us, even though I acknowledge that.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
The marginalization of people, women and women of color in particular, is very high. And even at the level of junior high school, one of the startling factors that I think we need to take into account is that, yes, young children, especially children who have been marginalized because of their sexual identity or their gender identity or racial identity, are experiencing the internet in a way that is very positive for them, but they're also being exposed to negatives, racist, sexist, homophobic, transphobic information at an increasingly high rate. At one point, I think in 2018, the numbers were startling and high for tweens, we'll call them. Like 64% reported that they had experienced racism or sexism or homophobism or some kind of hate over the internet. Even as they also say that, you know, but I find on the internet the opportunity to talk to people like myself who might feel isolated where I live, but I can reach out on the internet and connect with people. So it's a mix. And how do we balance the mix in favor of affirming humanity on the internet, as opposed to really devaluating and further marginalizing humanity?
Yeah, I so appreciate that sort of nuanced view of it. I can tell you, you know, from our perspective here at the Webby Awards, you know, we've seen over, you know, 20 plus years, we've seen so many examples of, you know, people in marginalized groups who would have been alone, you know, 30 years ago. And as you say, who found, you know, young LGBTQIA Black children, like all many, many different groups who were isolated in some way and faced some form of discrimination and were able to find peers or support you know, essentially because of the internet and the incredibly meaningful difference that made in their life, you know, so that's a real, real thing. And on the other hand, as you note, you know, at scale, you know, lots of women and specifically women of color and many, many others are really targeted in some of these places. And so I want to kind of connect that and ask you about, I've heard you say that you want to make sure that we don't leave it to the younger generation to solve these problems, that it's our responsibility as much as anyone's. And that the problem is that we are letting the younger generation inherit our broken systems. And I would suggest that this targeting that you see on the internet is really an inheritance of sort of a pre-internet system. It's just the internet is now sort of taken on a lot of these broken systems and biases, and we're seeing it play out again.
Yeah, I absolutely agree that this kind of sentiment is out there. It has been out there. It's, you know, continues to be expressed that the internet is just a platform for expressing it. But one of the things that makes the internet maybe a little more dangerous than some of the other ways of expression is that the anonymity and the lack of accountability or even traceability of some of the information that is coming in, and as well for different media. I mean, the great thing about the internet is that it's available to very young people, but some of them are not really ready emotionally and psychologically to deal with the information that they're getting. So I think we can do a couple of things. So one of the things that we can do is to make sure that our young people are more internet savvy, that they know how to navigate systems so that they're not overexposed to information that is really harmful to them psychologically and emotionally. And more importantly, that they are exposed to the information that can be helpful to them in their development. Mm.
And is that something you think about from a policy perspective as ultimately a professor of policy? How can the federal government and how can we write policies and create policies which enable those things to happen?
Right. I think about it in terms of policy. I think about it in terms of education. I mean, how do we educate children on the use of the internet, and how then, if they are exposed, what's the response? Because what happens very often is that you just create confusion and there's no one that they can go to get the answer to what they're supposed to be thinking about it. You know, one of the things that I think is an example of where this has been very important, the internet has been, is now that there is this movement across country to ban books. And we had one very close to where I live in a local neighborhood where they were attempting to ban books, both that were directed at children, queer children. And the internet, you know, allows for the anti-queer studies and queer information about being queer, what the identity and what it's like and how it feels. But it also has the, you know, it allows all of this information to come in at the same level, the anti. Mm-hmm. And what I think we need is much more of the information that affirms people for who they are and what their identities are, and to show how these books can be helpful to all children in schools. And so we need to think even beyond the children who are directly impacted by this, but we need to be educating all children in our schools about the importance of respecting one's and identity and respecting the identities of others.
It also ties back to, at the end of the day, who are the people who ultimately run these companies that mediate and moderate all this information? And do the people who work at these companies have, you know, an appreciation for these issues all the way up to the top, right? Because otherwise, if they don't, then you really just have it, like you have said before, it's an inheritance of, you know, the previous power structures into this power structure is really no different. It's just a sort of somewhat different setting.
Well, our markets peddle power.
Yeah.
And they thrive on power. And in many cases, it's the enemy of really progressive change. And so I think you're absolutely right. If the people at the top who are trading on the negative information are not accountable, self-accountable or accountable through the government or accountable through from their consumers, then we, you know, we will continue to perpetuate it. And what I can't understand is that how do they live with knowing that it will impact their children, their own children? And so maybe if we could convince people to see it from the ideas of their own loved ones, then maybe we could get more attention from the people at the top, whether it's the top of the government or the top of our businesses.
You also have a great podcast, which came out earlier this year. It's called Getting Even with Anita Hill, which I love the title. You described it as a podcast about equality and what it takes to get there. Tell me about what inspired you to start the podcast and what are you hoping to accomplish with it?
Well, as with so many things, I'm inspired by young people, and teaching gives me an opportunity to be inspired every day. And what I realized that as somebody who'd grown up in the 50s and the 60s, that I had a very limited sense of what equality was about and how to achieve it. You know, it was always drilled in for me that equality is about giving people opportunity to have a job or to go to a school. And what I realized as an adult is that that doesn't take into account, once you give them the opportunity and they even enter these places, that things are going to be equal. And so I thought the way that we think about equality and where it needs to be present and where our thinking needs to be present is very limited. It's structured around that thinking that we had in the 1960s and the 70s that were, you know, somehow governed by laws and defined by the courts. And I wanted to do something that thought about things outside of that. So I do have Thelma Golden talking about art space and studios and museums and how that needs to be equalized and equally respected, and the ways that people engage in those spaces can change. I did an interview with Misty Copeland, who talks about equality in ballet, where Black bodies are not necessarily respected and valued, and why that is, why the ballet aesthetic does not accept the Black body in the same way that it accepts the white body. I talk about venture capitalism with Arlen Hamilton. And in terms of gender race violence, I talked with W. Kamau Bell about his documentary series on Bill Cosby and how to balance those conversations so that, you know, we hear from the scores of women in the same way that we, you know, and balance their voices against this very powerful man with powerful contacts in the media and a huge reputation. So that all of those things are not necessarily what people, or not any of them are necessarily what people think of when they think of equality. But I think the more that we have those kinds of conversations, the more that we can get to an actual real equality in this country. In other words, that's how we get even.
In the episode, I think it's called With a Little Help from My Friends, you spoke to Emma Coleman Jordan and Beverly Guy Sheftall, as you referenced there, about the importance of just being heard as Black feminists, even if it didn't change things. Can you talk more about that? Just the importance of being heard and why that can be considered a milestone for activists? It seems to be like a theme of the podcast, I feel like.
Yeah, well, part of inequality is not being heard. I mean, we can't be equal if our voices are not heard, if we don't have a place, a platform for them, if the internet silences more of us than it amplifies us, then, you know, we're not going to ever be equal. And so being heard allows us to tell our stories, to tell our messages, to offer our perspectives. And it's the start, I think, of truly understanding what life is like for different individuals, people who we think of as different. You know, I mean, for me, I'll just go back to 1991. You know, there was not supposed to be a 1991 hearing. I was not supposed to be heard at all. And it was only because my statement was leaked and a whole set of factors intervened, including the fact that women from the House of Representatives went over and pushed the Senate, including there was public outcry, largely from feminists across the country to hear me. And I don't want to, you know, be self-congratulatory, but I believe that changed the conversation around gender violence in this country.
Absolutely.
And so just being heard can change outcomes in different ways than what we think. Now, of course, we all know that Clarence Thomas was on the Supreme Court, so it didn't change that. But I guess that what I'm trying to say is that there are consequences, even though some outcomes don't change. There will be consequences that people will be more informed and more engaged and more able to. Some people will come forward. Other people will become allies. Rules will change. The public can change. And so that's why I say being heard is the start of progress.
You know, the work of fighting for gender equality and racial equality, equality for LGBTQIA folks, it's really life work, and it's really hard work. And it sometimes leads to burnout. And I feel you, especially, you know, a career in that field and doing that work, but also I know someone that other people call to share all the trials and things they're going through and looking for support from you. I mean, that must be incredibly meaningful, but also emotionally, it's a lot, right? I feel like you, of all people, probably have dealt with more than anybody of any of it. How do you stay grounded? How do you restore yourself? And what advice can you give to other activists out there to continue on with it, even when it can be so hard sometimes?
Well, one of the things that I say comes really out of that podcast that I did with Emma Coleman Jordan and Beverly Guy Sheftall is that find people who are doing like thinking, like work, or who are with you. And that will be your support. That'll be your aid. That's what will keep you going when things get tough. But it also, finding those people energizes you and gives you new ideas, and staying up to date and using what power you have, but then understanding that you don't have infinite power, that you can't put all of the weight of the world on your shoulders.
One thing I wanted to share with our listeners that happened at the Webby Awards and that made me so optimistic and sort of overall excited about the future was seeing the reaction of our 1,000 people to you being there. And what I saw there was something that I knew about myself, but I hadn't necessarily thought about with others. And that's just the incredible impact you had on young people in the 1990s. And so while maybe 70% of the people after that, you know, hearing said they believed, or they believed Clarence Thomas or whatever it was, there was a whole generation of people that were my age that were, you know, maybe in their 20s or younger, who also watched it. And you became, you know, an icon for, and something that we all really, you know, treasured that you did that. So
yeah,
sorry to get teared up, but it really, it's just amazing to see how meaningful it was to so many people now. Yeah. And you see it visibly when the people are around you.
Well, I absolutely, that evening was thrilling. I did not expect the reception that I got. I was a little bit overwhelmed, and I like to pride myself in saying, as being somebody who doesn't lose her cool, but it was hard not to lose your cool. But I'm going to tell you a story, and I can end with this. I was at a high school once. It was a Votech school in Northern California, fairly, you know, low income or economic community. And kids went to the Votech school because they probably weren't going to go to college, and they needed to find things to be able to do to get employed. And you know, we were in a cafeteria setting, and they lined up for the mic. And so one of this young person, who from appearances identified as male, came up to the microphone. And I, you know, you never know when young people talk exactly what they're going to say, but he said something that stuck with me. And that was, how does it feel to know you've changed the world? And this was coming from a teenager. And I, you know, we didn't have a chance to talk too much, but, you know, and I don't know that I felt like I had changed the world at that point, but I knew that I had changed somebody's life. And so that's what I carry with me, that idea that I can change somebody's life. And this sort of answers both questions. The question that you had, how do you keep going? Keep knowing that you can change somebody's life.
Professor Hill, what an honor to have you on the Webby podcast. It was just an absolute pleasure for myself and everyone on the Webby Award team, and I know everybody at the Webby Awards, to have you join us this year. And thank you for all the continued work. I know that's a sentiment that's shared far and wide.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you for having me at the Webbies. I'm so glad to have discovered the Webbies and the people who are there and creating. And honestly, to tie into the story that I was telling before, I do believe that the people in that room are changing the world, and changing it for the better. So thank you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.